Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates one episode at a time, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which ran on CBS from 1972 to 1983, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining us in the VIP tent this week is Captain Ken Holzhauser. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Finest kind. I'm awfully glad to be here.
I'm really thrilled to have you here. You're really taking one for the team here because we're here to talk about Season 1, Episode 22, Major Fred C. Dobbs. And this show is sort of infamous in MASH history, but we'll get to all that in a moment. But Ken, of course, this is your first time on the show. I have to ask you, what's your history with MASH, the series?
Well, like a lot of people who've been on the show, I grew up watching MASH. I remember watching it from at least season two or three when it was regularly broadcast. I was a fan. I remember there was a period of time, and some of the listeners may correct me, but I think there was a period of time where it was on opposite Happy Days. And I remember going to my grandmother's house and running back and forth between two rooms where half of the family was camped out watching MASH and the other half was watching Happy Days and kind of zipping back and forth between commercials to try to keep caught up with everything in those pre-DVR days, ladies and gentlemen. And I grew up loving the show. It deeply, it deeply affected me. It made me the human I think I am today. There was a wonderful period when I was about 12 or 13 when MASH had really hit syndication hard. And there were two different UHF stations that ran MASH at different hours. So like from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. I could get an hour of MASH, then switch channels, and from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. get another hour of MASH.
Wow.
And then there were always there was a late night rerun at 10:30 p.m. on a station that I watched. So Mondays were the greatest because I would get three solid hours of MASH. I'd have the broadcast episode, 2 hours in the afternoon, and then a half hour wrap up in the evening before I went to bed. It was glorious.
People really, I think nowadays there's not as much syndicating of things because, of course, there's so many more options and streaming channels. But back in the day, syndication was where it was at. You know, if you got your show into syndication, that meant you were getting a fortune because, as you said, in certain stations it could run 3-4 hours a day worth of episodes. It's kind of amazing.
It's sad, really, to think about. I think MASH is just in that wheelhouse of the actors actually making money off of syndication. I think of all the shows I grew up watching, like Gilligan's Island or The Addams Family or The Monkees or something, where you basically got paid for one or two reruns and that's it. And those shows will be on TV forever.
Yes.
At least the cast of MASH will get a little check for something in the mail for all of these downloads or, you know, being able to be seen on Hulu. That's what you did. Thank you very much, Rob. And all of the other things like that. I mean, I'm glad to see that this entertainment isn't coming at the expense of, say, a check for Jamie Farr.
Absolutely, yes. If I put on an episode of MASH on Hulu and I know that somewhere some check is being cut to Loretta Swit for 9 cents, that makes me feel good. You know,
I'm like, that's
okay,
right.
Great. That's what it's the way it should be. So, well, that's awesome. That's fantastic. I said that's how kind of I grew up on MASH. I mean, I watched it during the later seasons as it aired, quote-unquote, live, but it was really in syndication that it came alive for me. So I love the idea of running back and forth. It's like, you know, way before picture-in-picture, you had to actually get up and move around. So that's fantastic. So very cool. And like I said, the episode we're here to talk about is Major Fred C. Dobbs. It aired on March 11th, 1973, written by Sid Dorfman, directed by Don Weiss. During surgery, Frank yells at Nurse Ginger Bayless so badly that she sheds a tear afterwards. After trying to console her, Hawkeye and Trapper decide to extract some revenge on him. Thus begins a week of Hawkeye and Trapper torturing Frank, pulling one prank after the next. One morning, Frank wakes up with his hand wrapped in a cast with a hook sticking out of it. This is the last straw for him, and he demands that Henry transfer him out. Even though Frank tells them he's being transferred, Hawkeye and Trapper don't know when to quit. They stick a microphone inside Hot Lips' tent as Frank tells her he's leaving. Their farewell scene is subsequently broadcast over the camp's PA, embarrassing Hot Lips so much she demands a transfer too. This enrages Henry, who holds Hawkeye and Trapper responsible for the 477's loss of a fair but competent general surgeon and a head nurse. Oops. Once Hawkeye and Trapper are told they have to pull double duty until Frank and Hot Lips are replaced, they realize they went too far and contrive a way to keep Frank at the 477th. They get their idea indirectly from Radar, who has been out in the Korean hills panning for gold, Korea being one of the world's largest gold producers. Even though they think Radar is foolish, they drop hints about the gold to Frank while they pretend to think he's asleep. They supposedly come back with bags full of it, actually the worthless mineral pyrite, and leave some of it out for Frank to find. He does, and when he goes wandering into the hills, he finds some more. He is so overwhelmed at the idea of being fabulously rich that he runs back to Henry, asking for his transfer to be canceled. Henry is enraged over all this, and he says that if he does that, this will be the last time. Frank agrees. He then tells Hot Lips and takes her out into the woods to show her the gold. There's a lot of it. A lot. The ground, the rocks, the trees, the PA speaker, even the Jeep Hawkeye and Trevor Jay buy-in are solid gold. Marco sits down at a nearby rock, frustrated that Frank has fallen for yet another trick. So the reason I say this episode is sort of infamous is that Major Fred C. Dobbs was mentioned in Susie Coulter's The Complete Book of MASH. Larry Gelbart said, when I look back at some of the first-year shows, I'm embarrassed. The one about Major Fred C. Dobbs, the worst. So no less an authority than Larry Gelbart said, this is the single worst episode they ever did. And then Alan Alda later on in an interview said his least favorite episode of MASH is Major Fred C. Dobbs. So, Ken, why did you want to talk about this one?
Well, certainly, if you can't do the best episode, you should probably take the shot at doing the worst one, because you could learn as much from what they're doing wrong here as you can what they're doing right. There's something interesting about this episode. It's not the episode itself, God knows. It's not the jokes, which land flat, or the hideously out-of-character behavior of, say, Margaret or anybody like that. It's, well, MASH Season 1 is kind of a strange animal. It's definitely, there's a lack of confidence at work with this show. It's, the ratings are low. They don't really know whether they're fish or fowl. They're getting all kinds of nasty notes from the network. I know Gene Reynolds said that they sent people from CBS who said, someday we're going to tell you how you screwed up MASH after right. They ran Sometimes You Hear the Bullet.
Right.
It feels like this whole episode is the actual epitome of the lack of confidence that they've got in Season 1, or maybe the interference from the network, because you can tell that CBS, when they picked up MASH, they were really wanting that kind of Sergeant Bilko, McHale's Navy, F Troop
right.
type of, you know, hijinks at the front line, you know, the Reader's Digest humor in uniform kind of thing, and they wanted to see Hawkeye and Trapper pull wacky stunts, do some con man shtick, and generally give everybody a pleasant half hour. And that's really not the show that anybody who was making it wanted to do. They wanted to have the social commentary. They wanted the humanism. They wanted the humor to be a reflection of the horrors of war. And boy, it is not on display here.
Yeah, I mean, when I rewatched this episode, and this is not a particularly great one, but when I rewatch it, I do think that they're all being a little unfair to it. I think the obviously building an episode around the detail that Korea is one of the world's largest gold producers is a pretty flimsy piece of information to hang a show all around. I mean, they Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds talked about that. They went to Korea and talked to people that actually served in MASH units and talked to veterans and talked to doctors that served. And they took a lot of the documentary information that they got, and they built episodes around it. Like Lifetime is like kind of built around that later on and things like that. So the fact that Korea's a big gold producer is pretty thin gruel. But that's okay. But it's you can make a good episode out of that. And I like all the pranks they pull on Frank and Hot Lips. I mean, in fact, the thing about broadcasting their speech is out of the movie.
Right.
I mean, it's a cleaned up version, because obviously in the movie they're broadcasting Frank and Hot Lips having sex. Here it's much more much more cleaned up. But I mean, the gags are fine. All the stuff with the dental work, all with Henry's dental problems, all that is fine. The only thing to me where this episode just breaks the goofy meter is the final scene where Hawkeye and Trapper have painted everything in gold. That's where you're just like, okay, we have now entered a completely unknown cartoonish universe where in the world of sitcoms, nothing really matters. It's all just a big goof. And that's really the only moment that at some point the writer should have said, this is too far. We're going too far. We get them. This is too silly. That's really it. It's so, I mean, to me, it's like if you had this episode minus that scene, It would have been one of their lesser episodes, but it wouldn't make you go, what? It's only that one moment that just, to me, is ruinous. And so I think that both Alan Alda and Larry Gelbart are being a little unfair, but maybe in their mind they just think of that scene of Hawkeye and Trapper driving by in the gold Jeep and saluting Frank, and you're just like, oh yeah, no, let's just move on to the next episode.
Well, much like fans, I'm sure that they're looking at Major Fred C. Dobbs through the lens of every episode that's going to come. There's 11 seasons of quality entertainment here, so it's easy to hold this one up and go, ooh, that's terrible. But really, if this episode in isolation was placed against other sitcoms that ran in 1973, it's probably pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly, all of the actors are good. If there's anything I wanted to kind of highlight with this is it's the thankless service of Larry Linville.
Yes.
Who plays, there's no other way to put it, but thankless. I mean, he is just the side of an awful cartoon character. I'm grateful whenever I rewatch the episode, I'm grateful that in the opening scene, there's no racial bias when he is upset with Ginger for not giving him his tools. Right. It's 1973. They could easily have gone there, and it would have just been one more thing that makes Frank unpleasant. But I'm really, really glad they don't, because it would have been a black eye for MASH for the future. But it's a terrible. He plays a terrible human being, and he does it really well. They try to give him a little bit more emotional heft in later seasons, but it's really hard to do because Frank Burns is built on just being this awful, oafious creature. And I remember growing up thinking, I will never see anybody this unlikable and horrible as a human being. This is just unfair. I don't believe this. And then I saw Ted Cruz, and I thought, oh, my God.
There you go.
Any human equivalent of Frank Burns, it's Ted Cruz, an unlikable ferret face that just is – who wants the glory but doesn't want to do the work for it, who wants the valor but he doesn't want the responsibility. Oh, my Lord.
I kind of wondered where you were headed with that, and then I realized I'm never going to not be able to make that connection, so thank you, Ken.
Well, there should be something pleasant about Ted Cruz, and at least we can now think of Larry Linville when we look at his awful, awful face.
Right. I mean, I've heard about, they've read in many books that they said that Larry Linville was the nicest guy imaginable. And they said it was really hard for him to kind of be buddy-buddy with everybody on the set, and everybody was Joshua, and then he had to go right on stage and just be such a miserable bastard. So I could see why that they would cartoon him up in later seasons as he just got sort of sillier and sillier. Because, yeah, one of the ongoing motifs through MASH that I like is that when the thing that offends Hawkeye and Trapper the most about Frank is when he's mean to the nurses. That is what really sets them off. And when he makes Ginger cry, and this is probably Odessa Cleveland's best moment as Ginger. Mm-hmm. She didn't really get a whole lot to do in later seasons, but she would get little bits here and there. But here she actually gets a little bit of dramatic, a dramatic moment where they follow her out of the OR, and then she's crying because she's been berated by Frank in front of everybody. I love that that's what Hawkeye and Trapper just – they can't abide that. And then they do this full court press of just making Frank's life miserable with all these pranks. But I just think that that's sweet that they're not doing it just because they don't like Frank. They're doing it kind of in solidarity for the nurses, which I really appreciate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it is a pity that Odessa Cleveland didn't get more to do with the show. I think, again, we're now back to judging the show for being 1973. I think maybe 2 years later, Ginger could have been – a romantic interest for Hawkeye or Trapper or Henry or just about anybody. But I think maybe at that time that was still maybe a bridge too far for CBS, which is sad. She's a likable actress, and Ginger's an interesting character. It's just unfortunate that there's little for her to do once they decide that there's no room on the show for Spearchucker.
Right. We do see her dancing with Trapper in a later episode. They're in a romantic clinch, and they're slow dancing together. And she says something like, "This is nice." And Trapper's like, "Imagine what we could do without the music," or something like something really saucy. Like, wow, okay, good for them. Yeah. But yeah, I think she does a good job here for the little bit they give her. The other major character we see is the dentist, Kaplan, played by Harvey Goldenberg, who would come back in the very in two episodes later in Showtime, and these would be his only two appearances on MASH. He had appearances in shows like That Girl, Bob Newhart, Kojak, Alice, The Wonder Years. I'm always amazed that, like, after a certain point, I think after season two, we never see a MASH dentist again. They had to have one. Every unit had one, but they just chose to never show the dentist ever again. I guess because maybe it's a complicated thing of, like, well, dentists are doctors, but they're not surgeons. And so they wanted to really pare the unit down to just being, there's four doctors and that's it. We don't need to have a fifth doctor. So if you have this dentist character, you're always kind of having to, well, shouldn't he be helping out with wounded? I mean, you know, he's got some medical training, so what's that about? But it's in these early shows, we see a lot of a dentist. You know, Michael Lerner will come back. It will come in season two as a dentist. But after this, after season two, like, the dentists just sort of fade off into oblivion.
Well, maybe the implications of a frontline dentist is horrific, because obviously you'd want a dentist in a medical unit for reconstructive dental surgery, because obviously there's going to be some pretty horrific facial injuries, and maybe that's just, I don't know, maybe that's just a little too graphic for what MASH was going to be. And much like Just Plain MacArthur, the Armed Forces radio soap opera hit, they're both very much pieces of MASH the movie. They're like the lingering remnants of the movie that they're trying to pull out before the show becomes its own kind of version of MASH.
I guess they figured that the movie's most famous prank, where they pull the shower doors up on Margaret while she's nude. Like, there's no way to do an edited version of that on MASH. I get that. Like, that would be too – you could never subject Loretta Swit's Margaret Houlihan to that, because she – you get the sense that that version of Margaret would have never tolerated that prank. Like, that would have been the end of – she would have literally decked Hawkeye and Trapper for doing that.
Plus, for CBS to show it, they would have to do an extreme close-up of Loretta Swit from, like, the chin up.
Yeah.
Looking shocked, so you couldn't even imply what's going on.
Yeah. This version of the gag where they broadcast their lovey dovey is, again, it's the safest version they could do from the movie.
And Kaplan the dentist, I do remember him from a couple episodes from now. That's in the future, dear listeners. But he really kind of leans on sort of a weird Groucho Marx Woody Allen characterization for this too.
He's very Woody Allen. And yeah, absolutely.
The next episode, he's extremely Woody Allen. I remember watching him do his sort of vague Groucho stuff, and I'm thinking, oh, no. Alan Alda does the Groucho stuff on this show. You, bit player, you don't get to do the Groucho. That's for Alan Alda.
That's interesting. Yeah, they might be, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing there, Harvey Goldberg? Stop it. He's doing that. This episode features the return of the weird MASH theremin music, which they would love to do when they would do an eerie scene, and they would do it's a very discordant note on MASH, just because they wouldn't use it in later seasons, but here they use it a couple of times. But it always jumps out at me when I hear them try and do eerie music on this show.
It's also the last appearance of the swinging jazzy version of Suicide is Painless, and
that's right.
That again strikes me as that lack of confidence thing where they're. Suicide is Painless starts off in kind of a spare, haunting way, and you're just so used to it being the theme to MASH. This jazzier version may make it a little bit more, you know, TV compatible, but it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, you're picturing like this big band, you know, with all these guys dressed in tuxedos and just ba 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 ba, and it's just like, this is inappropriate. The song is called Suicide is Painless. This is an inappropriate arrangement for this song.
They just finished like Moonlight Serenade. It's like, all right, guys, let's launch into Suicide is Painless. Look at these kids on the dance floor.
Les Brown and his band of renown are now going to serenade us with Suicide is Painless. Okay. Of course, the title, Major Fritzy Dobbs, is taken from the movie Treasure of the Sierra Madre, where Humphrey Bogart plays Fritzy Dobbs, a gold prospector who slowly goes mad. So this is another one of those little references, basically to entertain the MASH writers, because of course these episode titles were never seen. You only knew they were sort of done internally. But this was just something, I guess, again, just to sort of, you know, make themselves smile, because nobody else would know it. And for years, until I saw Treasure of the Sierra Madre, I never knew what the title referenced. I didn't understand what Fritzy Dobbs meant. And then I finally saw the movie and, oh, okay, it's a good reference.
Oh, I'm in the same boat with that too. And I was that kid who could tell you all about the jewel mountains of Krypton and what each different component of kryptonite did for you and all of that super nerdy DC Comics lore. So, yeah, as soon as they started to put out books listing the titles, then it was off to the races for me. I had to memorize all of this.
Have you ever seen Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
I have. A long time back, I watched a lot of Bogart movies in a run. I remember I probably stumbled on The Maltese Falcon, and I was just knocked out and then spent forever trying to track down as many Bogey movies as I could.
Yeah, I love Sierra Madre. I got to see it on the big screen a couple of years ago, which was just phenomenal.
Nice.
Oh, if any of you listening have not seen Treasure of the Sierra Madre, check it out. It's an amazing movie. Absolutely amazing. Just great performances. Humphrey Bogart and just a John Huston movie. It's just wonderful. So obviously it loomed large in the imagination of the MASH writers for them to use it like this. The final scene, the just before the credits. Does that scene feel ad-libbed to you? It feels ad-libbed to me because it feels like the actors are like stepping on each other's lines and stuff, where Hawkeye grabs Frank and kisses him and Margaret gets mad. It's very messy. It doesn't seem really structured. It feels like they just told the actors, here, just kind of do this and we'll film it.
Well, strangely enough, it feels the most like MASH of any of the scenes mm-hmm. in the episode. So, yeah, I do feel like that was probably just thoroughly improvised. Like they had some sort of a button scene, you know, where everybody shakes hands and then somebody, you know, then Hawkeye makes a reference and that, oh, you guys, you know, the Scooby-Doo ending. But that was definitely a more fun ending to the episode. Helps redeem the scene before it with the golden jeep.
Right. Yeah. It's fun to watch Wayne Rogers is in the background just laughing at all of it. Like he's barely not even participating. He's just watching because he grabs Frank and forces a lip lock on him and Margaret flips out and then he's like, I'll get to you next. And while Larry Lindell is throwing his fist wildly trying to get it to stop. So, as I mentioned, this episode was directed by Don Weiss, who did 16 episodes of MASH. He was a very good director. He's solid, could deliver the scenes in an effective way. And I mentioned it was written by Sid Dorfman, who only did a couple of episodes, but he did do the Army-Navy game, which we just talked about, and Iron Guts Kelly, which is another really good one. So this, you know, those are really good episodes. I mentioned Army-Navy game is actually my favorite of this season. And Iron Guts Kelly, when we get to it, is fantastic, not just because there's a character called Robert Iron Guts Kelly in it. Sid could do, you know, this is a pretty weak episode, but he also could do great episodes. So, you know, it was just kind of what you had to work with in any given moment. I mean, I would imagine if you were handed the piece of information, Korea is a large gold producer, here, build an episode around that, you'd be a little like, all right, let me see if I can make this entertaining.
Well, that's the thing. I think of Sid as kind of like a journeyman writer.
Yeah.
What did he do, like 150 episodes of Burns and Allen? I mean,
yeah, extensive TV credits.
He's got the skills to get them something, get them a television script on time. It's very possible that they had almost nothing to finish out the season. And yeah, you're right. They probably said, hey, you know, Korea does produce a lot of gold. And everybody just kind of looked around each other and was like, well, Sid can do something with it, I guess.
Yeah. I like that Radar has enough free time to go out panning for gold. He comes back with his with his donkey and his bag full of gold. And they kind of write him – they were all over the place with Radar, as I mentioned in previous episodes, because there's somewhere in the Long John Flap where he's kind of like an operator, you know, with women. And then there's other ones where – the love story where we find out he's got a fiance. And then there's Army-Navy game where he romances a nurse and gets her into the supply shed. And then there's other episodes where he's like a little boy. But here, they kind of act like he's dumb because Hawkeye and Trapper tell him, you don't have gold, Radar. This is pyrite. It looks like gold, but it's not really gold. And Radar just dismisses him, and he's like, that's gold, I tell you. And Radar really looked up to Hawkeye and Trapper. He would not dismiss them. He would not be like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. So Radar's a little out of character in this one, too, I would say.
He's almost two different characters in it because you've got that early scene where he's a little bit of, like, you know, the get-rich-quick Ralph Cramden-y kind of, oh, I'm going to go prospect for gold because I just read in a book, you know. And then we get proper teddy bear Radar later in the episode when Frank comes to borrow his prospecting tools.
Right. Yeah.
And that so seemed a little bit more natural.
Yeah. They said they are a bit all over the place here. Do you have a particular favorite line or favorite joke from this episode?
Boy, that's a hard one. The sequence where just before they're about to play Just Plain MacArthur, where they're sitting there and they're bantering around, you know, Freud said it best when he said, never ask for like chocolates and things like that. Or, I think he's beginning to soften up. I mean, that's probably the best part of it for me. The, you know, that's just a vicious rumor started by people I've fallen over. I mean, that sequence is fine by me. I like that very much. So that's probably my favorite segment of dialogue in the episode.
I do like just plain MacArthur. Like, that's a great title. MASH was always good at coming up with fake movies and fake TV shows. I was going to say I don't want to spoil it, but good Lord, it's like 10 seasons from now, so we can get to it again. They have another joke later on where Hawkeye talks about that the only new movie we've gotten is the PSA film, The Field Pack, Your Canvas Buddy. And, like, I laugh at that every time I hear just the idea that there's a movie called The Field Pack, Your Canvas Buddy. So just plain MacArthur is just – that just makes me laugh. That's just a great, great title for the idea of turning Douglas MacArthur into a sitcom radio character. That's very funny to me. My favorite line is not even so much a – I mean, it's a joke, but it – I don't know. It's not that funny, but it's when Hot Lips is telling Frank about the special dinner she has planned for him. And she says to Frank, "I got the cook to make pork chops just the way you like them, with extra fat." Oh, that makes me nauseous. Oh, it's so
but
gross.
But I love the incredibly breathy, loving way that she says, "extra fat."
Oh, ew, it's so gross. Beautiful. Oh, it's so disgusting. It makes me just like blech. And I mean, it's meant to make you a little nauseous, and it does the trick. So that is, in a weird way, my favorite line, because it's just deeply upsetting. So yeah, I mean, I think Larry Gelbart is being a little harsh on this one. There are lines in later episodes that we'll get to that are pretty grim. They don't ruin episodes, but there are some jokes that I think MASH probably has a lot to answer for. And there's nothing here that's that bad. It's just a silly, forgettable episode. And when you realize that it comes after Sometimes You Hear the Bullet, it casts it at even sort of starker relief, that it's like, wow, they're really doing something silly this week, when a couple of weeks ago they really knocked it out of the park. So, you know, it's just the way TV sitcom production goes. You know, I mean, maybe if they had ran this before Sometimes You Hear the Bullet, but it doesn't. And so it can't help but seem very strange in comparison.
I'm not for sure, but they may have even recorded this way before, and we're just kind of hanging on to it to bury it towards the end of the season.
Maybe so. Yeah, I don't know. So I think that is going to do it for Major Fred C. Dobbs. So, Ken, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. It's great talking to you.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
All right. Well, where can people
Love
find you?
Oh,
thank you. Well, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, if you're looking for me, I'll be gassing on and on any form of social media about my comic, The Quick and the Dad, which is available in print and digital at indieplanet.com. And you'll find me on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatever the kids are doing these days, smoke signals, that kind of thing.
We'll have that link in the show notes. Very cool. Congratulations on doing your own comic book. That's a tough hill to climb.
It is, but I absolutely love it. Ever since I was a kid, when I first realized that people actually did this for a living, so thank you, Stan Lee, for credit boxes, that was the thing I wanted to do with my life. And when I hit a certain age, I decided I'm going to do it myself. If the mountain won't come to Muhammad, I'll do it. And I'm having a lot of fun.
Very cool. Excellent. Thank you very much. Well said. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Of course, if you want to find back episodes of the show, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes and on Stitcher and, of course, on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is at MASH477cast. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that is all.
Okay, Frank, you'll get your transfer.
Thank you.
You know, Frank, as rough as it's been sometimes, I think I'll miss you.
Well, it might not have come to this if you'd had the backbone to maintain some discipline around here.
Well, so much for missing you.